The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day one of this 7-day session at Mountain Gate in July 2014. And I'd like to share a little bit of history here with you. In this case, the autobiography of Yamada Mumon Roshi, who was Harada Shoto Roshi's teacher. He was born in 1900 and died in 1988. And without anything more, I'll just put it into his words, at least as translated into English. This is from a writing called My Spiritual Home, autobiography by Yamada Mumon Roshi. In the mountains of northeast Aichi Prefecture, not far from Mikuni Pass, on the border between the ancient feudal provinces of Mino and Shinano, lies a valley at the headwaters of the Yahagi River. In this valley, lying at nearly 2,000 feet above sea level, is a village named Busetsu, a rustic community where the old beliefs still persist. Even now, the villagers believe that swallowing live salamanders from the river will keep summer fevers at bay. The local delicacy, regarded by the villagers as the rarest of treats, is made by spreading a thin, rectangular piece of cryptomeria wood with rice paste, roasting it over charcoal till the surface turns a light brown, then spreading miso or sesame soy sauce on top of it. In the past, Busetsu provided lodgings for travelers on the Iida Highway, the road that ran from Nagoya over the mountains to the town of Iida in Shinshu Province. During the summer, white-robed pilgrims heading for the holy mountain Ontake would walk by ringing their little hand bells. Worshippers returning from the great temple Zenkoji in the north of Shinshu could be recognized by the pretty souvenir baskets strapped to their backs. Nowadays, the village has a small bus station served by the buses of the Tokyu Meihan line. This is the village where I was born, with a barely noticed cry, in a neighborhood listed in the government register as Oaza Choji Yashiki. The name meaning something like, quote, the residences in the main part of the village, is a strange one. I suspect it came to be called that because Busetsu once had a fort guarding the border between the Mino and Shinano domains, and the samurai garrisoning the outposts had their estates in the more developed section of town. We also wondered about the village name, but we don't need to go into any of that. It's a little bit of a strange name, but again, we don't need to go into it. And we're going to jump a little bit here because he talks a lot about the history of the area, the long history of the area. And then he continues. From the time I was born, I was raised in this remote little village with its long history of loyalty to the country and the imperial throne. And the history that he has spoken of documents the fights between the imperial forces and the forces of the shogunate and the various different battles that went on and so forth. It's not so much of importance to us here. But he writes that from the time I was born, I was raised in this remote little village with its long history of loyalty to the country and the imperial throne. From the time we were first graders, we were toughened with hard training in the winter cold, all the while singing in loud voices such songs as, "Behold ye, Asuke Shigenori," demonstrating his reverence for the words of the Kenmu emperors. He raised high the banner of righteousness and fought with single-minded valor, meeting his fate at the castle of Mount Kasagi. Boundless was his distinguished service. The Japanese still today think that it's important to train their children in hardiness. And the little nursery school that was near Sogenji when I was training there. In the winter time, and it gets quite cold in Okoyama, it snows. I have seen the temperature actually on the thermometer at 14 degrees. And that's Fahrenheit. And the little kids in the nursery school, these are 2, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, actually they look like they're mostly about 2 or 3, would run around in during the daytime, during I guess what was their recess, in little shorts with bare chests. Every once in a while there was a child that had a little bit more clothing on, but most of the kids ran around basically with no clothing on their longer legs or on their upper body. And the school uniform in Japan for everybody in the lower grades, for the boys, is shorts. It's not, they don't get into long pants until I think it's high school. And so they're walking daily in the cold, in the winter, with uncovered legs, just kind of like American kids do. And back to Yamada Mumonroshi. Though later in my life I developed a considerable interest in socialist thought, I think I have the influence of this early training and perhaps of the blood of my ancestors to thank for the fact that I never went on to espouse communism. The family I was born into operated a warehouse and transport agency on the highway that passed through the village. Teamsters on their way up and down the road would often stop to unload or reload their wagons or to shift cargoes to vehicles heading for different destinations. And they carried various different things. He remembers seeing a lot of salted fish, sometimes some sweets, which sometimes these men who drove the wagons would share with him, and sometimes just general things. And then he said, from Shinshu to the north came cargoes consisting largely of logs, sawn lumber, and charcoal. But I also remember seeing bark from the Mitsumata shrub for papermaking, and there was also bark from the maki tree, which might have been used to make dye. At noontime, the wagon drivers would gather around the hearth in the middle of our large kitchen and eat their boxed lunches. My father always made a point of preparing warm bowls of miso soup or vegetable stew for them. The nearby mountains were also full of sawyers, as well as charcoal burners who had moved up from the Ibi River area in Mino Province. My father always enjoyed asking strangers in for some dinner, so when these people came to town, they would stop at our house for something to eat before returning to the mountains. At certain times of the year, monks from the lodging temples of Zenkoji, Taiyu priests from Ise Shrine, the shrines are Shinto. And Zenkoji, I believe there's a note later in this writing that it was a Pure Land temple. Ascetics from Mount Ontake and mountain priests from Togakushi would come to town to distribute talismans and perform invocations. They would stay for several days, basing themselves at our house as they made the rounds of neighboring villages. So he grew up with a lot of people from a lot of different places around. Every evening, my father would entertain these people with sake and snacks. My mother would wait on them with help from the maids, as though she were the proprietress of a tavern or inn. I never heard her complain, though, as she quietly went about serving complete strangers. My father used to tell the young fellows, making money isn't at all difficult. If you keep working, there'll always be enough. What's hard is spending money. I don't recall him ever doing anything unusually praiseworthy, but he was always generous when it came to supporting religion or showing hospitality to others. On the other hand, my father couldn't abide anything crooked. Once I saw him shouting as he took the rod to a manservant bound to a post in one of the outbuildings, and my mother tried to stop him, saying that he didn't have to be so brutal. My father became even angrier and turned around to hit her. She fled out the back gate toward the rice paddies in her bare feet, with me following after her, crying. Apparently, my father had found out that the manservant was gambling on the side. Another time, he heard that one of the men of the local shrine association had developed a taste for beef. "They say you're eating the meat of four-legged animals," he told the man. You needn't bother coming to association meetings anymore. And this is interesting. They did eat fish. My father was completely unbending on matters like this. When one of my older brothers sent a letter home using an envelope from the company he worked for, he received a severe scolding. "It doesn't matter, even if it's just a single envelope," admonished my father. "If you take company property and put it to private use, it's still theft." That being the way he was, my father would thunder at anyone and everyone in the village who he felt had acted improperly. It was always my long-suffering mother who had to step in and try to calm my father in his implacable rages and do what she could to prevent the other person from taking offense. From my father, I learned that there are such things as right and wrong, and that sometimes anger is justified in the service of what is right. From my mother, I learned, contradictory though it may seem, that forgiveness must be accorded to everyone and that all human beings must be treated kindly. In the midst of that turbulent household, I grew up as an introverted child who spent most of his time in his room reading books. I don't recall running around outside with the other kids much. I'm not sure exactly which books I read, but I remember that it was at about that time that boys' magazines like Nihon Shonen and Shonen Kurabu first appeared, along with Japanese translations of Western novels like The Count of Monte Cristo. I used to order these new publications and pass them along my friends when I was finished with them. Sounds like his family was reasonably well-to-do, since he was able to spend money like that and since they obviously had servants. For some inexplicable reason, I also enjoyed staying at home practicing calligraphy and painting like some old retired gentleman. I would take up my brush and produce sumi-e, to which I'd assign poetic titles like White Water or something. That was the sort of child I was. I used to bring poems to the old folks' haiku gatherings in the village, receiving high marks on occasion. If any of these early efforts were still around, someone might mistake them for the work of some prodigy, but fortunately all have disappeared. And then he says something interesting. "I have no idea why the young son of a rural transport agent came to be so fascinated by ink paintings and haiku. It often makes me think that life doesn't begin with our present existence, but has its roots far in the past, so that this world is simply a continuation of former lives. I often meet people and sense that this isn't the first time I've encountered them, that I've met them once before somewhere, no, not somewhere, but in a previous existence. I'm not sure what to make of this feeling. In the biographies of ancient monks, one often comes across statements like, quote, 'You and I were at Vulture Peak together listening to the sermons of the Buddha,' close quote. I feel that way sometimes myself. Could such feelings arise from some mysterious intuition deep in our physical being?" He also apparently strongly felt that he was a reincarnation of Hakuin, and that would make sense of the deep interest in calligraphy and sumi-e, which is the ink painting, and haiku, or at least certainly the calligraphy work and the sumi-e, because Hakuin was prolific with his calligraphy and his painting. There are literally thousands of scrolls still extant that he had done to inspire his students and other people. When I was 14 years old, my brother took me to Tokyo. It's time for him to go to a higher level school. My father woke me up in the pre-dawn darkness and took me to the ancestral shrine in Ubasuna, Nomori, where he told me to say farewell to the family deities. I pressed my small palms together and in my heart promised that I'd make something of myself before I returned. Conjuring up dreams of coming back one day as, say, Prime Minister of Japan, I took my leave of that grassy village in the mountains. Travel conditions at the time were much worse than they are now. The first 23 kilometers as far as the town of Asuke had to be walked. On the way, travelers had to cross the steep Isegami Pass. The name Isegami Pass literally means Ise God Pass, but the original name was apparently Ise Ogami Pass, which would have been Ise Viewing Pass. Since on a very clear day one could see all the way to Ise, almost 100 kilometers to the southwest. Every year at that time of the Kaname ritual, when the emperor made offerings of new rice to Ise deity on October 17th, a simultaneous observance was held at this pass. And he talks about the older kids, school kids, would go take part in it. And he says, after the long walk to Asuke, we made our way to the city of Okazaki in a horse-drawn coach, a vehicle I'd never ridden before in. It swayed and clattered its way along the road on the banks of the Yagi River with a transfer halfway to our destination. It was about 4 kilometers from the town center of Okazaki to the railroad station with an electric trolley, the first I'd ever seen, connecting the two. It was already dark by the time we boarded, so as I looked out of the windows, it seemed not so much that the trolley was moving, but that the streetlights were flowing steadily by. I thought it a beautiful sight. Reaching the station, we boarded the night train for Tokyo. Needless to say, riding a train was also a first-time experience for me. We arrived in Tokyo the following morning and stopped for a while at the home of my aunt. Everything in Tokyo was a surprise to me. It was almost as though I had gone straight from the wilds of Africa to the city of London. My aunt served us some tuna sashimi, and after I had tried some, I asked her if tuna was an ocean fish. When she said it was, I asked, then why doesn't it taste salty? Everyone laughed at my question. Until then, though, the only ocean fish I'd ever eaten had been salted salmon and dried sardines, so I thought that all ocean fish were salty, because he lived inland. My brother was attending Waseda University, so I enrolled at Waseda Middle School and took lodgings in Otsuka Kubo at the student dormitory run by the Mikawa Friendship Society, Mikawa being the region where my home village was located. Every day I commuted to school from the dormitory, walking over Kuze Hill and along the Edo River. Waseda's headmaster at the time was Okuma Nobutsune, the son of Waseda University's founder, Okuma Shigenobu. Shigenobu was still alive at the time, and I would often catch sight of his carriage along Tsunomakicho Avenue. At the time, the ties between the various schools and the Waseda network were still strong, so the middle school was fortunate enough to have young teachers from the university come to teach. I remember several of them particularly well. And he goes on to list a few. And then he says, not long after the end of the Second World War, I was in the ancient city of Izumo, lecturing at a certain temple, when by sheer coincidence I ran into Ando Kosei, an old classmate of mine under Professor Aizu. It was the first time in 30 years that I'd met Ando, who in the meantime had succeeded Aizu at Waseda University and made quite a name for himself as an art historian. He was cataloging Izumo's Buddhist statuary when we met. In the course of our conversation, we reminisced, of course, about Professor Aizu, who at the time was living in retirement in his native Niigata. As soon as I returned from Izumo, I sent a letter to Professor Aizu, the first I had written to him since graduation. He wrote a warm reply saying he remembered me well, and we went on to correspond for some time. One autumn, I received a letter from him saying that he would be visiting Nara the following fall and that he would call on me while he was in the area. The trip never came to pass, however, as he passed away that spring. His death deeply saddened me. And then he had a different experience. Another of my teachers at Waseda was Tanabe Hisao, who taught us physics, although he later became well-known in Japan as a music critic. Not long ago, I met him, again by pure chance, in the baths of the hot springs resort of Unzen in Kyushu, both of us stark naked. Unlike Professor Aizu, he had no memory of me whatsoever. This was probably because I was quite poor at physics, and Professor Tanabe may have dismissed me as a hopeless student. It was disappointing, but I have only my own lack of study to blame. The teacher who most profoundly influenced my subsequent life is Matsumoto Ko, who was a professor of Chinese literature. Although his health is not quite as vigorous as before at the time of this writing, and unfortunately there's no date on this piece of writing, he remains hale at the age of 90. When I celebrated my Kaido ceremony at Myoshinji some time ago, he came all the way from Tokyo to attend. Delighted that the headstrong student who had given him so much trouble had finally managed to make something of himself. He's a wonderful teacher whose old eyes well up with tears whenever he meets me. The Kaido ceremony is the ceremony where one reaches the rank or receives the rank that is essential for one to become a head of Myoshinji. Myoshinji is an extremely large Rinzai Zen Buddhist temple in Kyoto. There are 44 temples altogether as part of that complex. And it's quite an honor to become the head of all of them. And Yamada Momon did that. And it was this Kaido ceremony that made him eligible to become the head. It was owing to Professor Matsumoto's influence that from my fourth year at middle school, the Confucian Analects became for me an indispensable guide. I kept the text always at hand, becoming so addicted to it that I practically had it memorized. There was one line in particular that struck me, and this is significant because his father had intended him to become a lawyer. In hearing litigation, I am the equal of any man. This is what Confucius wrote. But what is truly needed is for litigation to be eliminated. In hearing litigation, I am the equal of any man. But what is truly needed is for litigation to be eliminated. It was this line that first disrupted the smooth flow of my life. Confucius was confident that as a judge, he could adjudicate lawsuits in as just a manner as possible. What he truly sought was not this, though, but the creation of a peaceful society in which lawsuits never occurred. When I first came across this line, I felt as though I'd run into a large wall and had the wind knocked out of me. Painful thoughts poured through my mind. The fact that my father's hope was to make me a lawyer or a judge probably intensified my feelings. But in any event, Confucius' words loomed up and blocked my way. I thought to myself, a world without litigation, isn't this the ideal we're striving toward as human beings? Lawsuits and trials are no more than stopgap measures that take problems and paper them over. Prosecuting and defending are simply ways for lawyers to earn a living. What is the ultimate goal of life? What is the ultimate goal of life? This question formed a barrier before which I stood in a daze, not knowing what to do. In hearing litigation, I'm the equal of any man, but what is necessary is to eliminate the need for litigation. Expanding on this idea a bit, we might say, as a doctor, I could equal any man in curing disease, but what I truly yearn for is a world free of illness. We could also say, as a soldier, I'm certain I could prevail in battle, but my ideal is to create a harmonious world where war no longer exists. Or, as a businessman, I could outdo anyone in making money, but what I'd really like to see is a society where people need not worry about money. All of this is fine, but what is the ultimate goal of our human existence? When I pondered how I might go about resolving this question, I came up with nothing. Thus began my years of spiritual drifting. I became a strange boy who, after chemistry and physics classes, would look down. Whoops. Who during chemistry and physics classes would look down and read the Lotus Sutra. I was a great admirer of Takayama Chogyu, whose novel Takiguchi Nyudo was a bestseller at the time, as well as Kunigida Doppo and Tolstoy. By this time, I'd lost any desire to continue my education. He's only in middle school. And as a result, my grades dropped dramatically. I managed to graduate by the skin of my teeth, but I didn't even bother to attend the commencement ceremony. Graduation meant nothing to me. I nevertheless took the entrance exams for the Daiichi Koto Gakko, the first higher school in Tokyo, knowing that my father expected it of it. I failed, of course. There was no way I could have passed, given my mood at the time. I spent the following year studying and sat for the entrance exams at the Daihachi Koto Gakko, the 8th high school in Nagoya, but the result was the same. Perhaps if they posed questions about the Tanisho, which is a Buddhist writing, or the Bible, I could have done better, but that was hardly likely. Meanwhile, all of my friends from Waseda Middle School were being accepted to the schools of their choice. I viewed them with some envy, not because they had succeeded in entering famous institutions, but because they were able to proceed with their lives free of any hesitation or sense of questioning. During the years following the First World War, Tokyo was the scene not only of many social and political movements, but also of much religious activity. Anyone walking in Kanda at night was sure to come across soldiers of the Salvation Army beating their drums, or followers of the Buddhist Revival Army blowing their trumpets. At the temple Rinshoin in Yushima, one could hear Zen lectures at the gatherings held by Sugawara Jiho, while at the Gudokan in Morikawa, a lively schedule of Dharma meetings was offered by the Jodo Shin minister, Chikazumi Jokan. In Fujimicho, the sermons of the Christian minister Uemura Masahisa won a wide audience among the student population. Uchimura Kanzo, too, had an enthusiastic following of younger believers. Meanwhile, Miyazaki Toranosuke, the prophet of the new religion, Shinsei Kyodan, could be seen in Ueno Park haranguing the crowds, his long hair blowing in the wind and his frock-coated chest thrust out. And if you went to the Central Buddhist Hall, you could hear someone lecture each and every evening. It was truly a time of religious ferment. Like a starving stray, I wandered about Tokyo, sniffing out the slightest sense of truth. My favorite destination was probably Chikazumi Jokan Center, the Gudokan. Many years later, and he talks about going to one place where it was like an abandoned-looking house, and he always found the guy asleep in bed, along with his daughter asleep, and so he wasn't sure about them. They seemed to be always starving, and years not so long after that, he found that they had all died. And one day, I heard that Uchimura Kanzo was holding a prayer gathering at a church in Tsunohazu. So I went all the way there to attend. After Uchimura's rousing sermon, we were told that the second coming of Christ would occur that very evening. So the entire congregation offered fervent prayers far into the night. The Lord never did descend from heaven. It seemed pointless to study with no intention of attending college, so I finally entered the Department of Indian Philosophy at Toyo University in order to learn more about Buddhism. The courses I took there, Buddhist History by Sakaino Koyo, president of the school, Buddhist Doctrine by Professor Shimaji Taito, the History of Chinese Thought by Dr. Unno Teto, Sociology by Professor Nakajima Tokuzo, English Literature by Professor Tanabe Juji, and others were all of great interest and contributed much to my intellectual development, but they provided no key to my understanding of the ultimate purpose of life. One day, at the invitation of a friend, I listened to a lecture on Shantideva's Way of the Bodhisattva, given by Kawaguchi Ekai Roshi, a Zen priest who had established the Snow Mountain Monastery in the Yayoi-cho neighborhood of Tokyo's Hongo district. The text, transcribed on pages of straw paper, contained a passage that went roughly as follows. If I could cover the entire surface of the earth with leather, I could freely walk anywhere in bare feet, but that would not be possible. This is a teaching of the Buddha, by the way. However, with just 9 inches of leather on the soles of my feet, it's just the same as if I had covered the entire surface of the earth. Likewise, it is probably impossible to make this earth an ideal paradise. But if I arouse the mind of Bodhi, of awakening, that is, if I vow to offer all I have for the sake of humankind, then it is just as though earth had become a paradise. How deeply moved I was when I read this passage. These lines precipitated the second turning point of my spiritual life. It is said that there's no end point for progress in science, and the same thing can be said, I think, for the progress of the human race. Even if it were impossible to achieve paradise on earth, it would probably require hundreds of millions of years and an equal effort to covering the entire surface of the earth with leather. But if I put just 9 inches of leather on the soles of my feet, it's just the same as if I had covered the entire surface of the earth. If I just arouse the mind of Bodhi, it is just as though an ideal pure land in all its perfection had come into existence. So the sacred text said. This is the way, I thought. With a sense of utter conviction, I felt that this path, the path of immediately manifesting the pure land, of immediately perfecting the self right here, right now, saving the world and saving myself, was the only path for me. It is enough to vow in one's heart to offer everything one has for the sake of humanity. If that's the case, then even I can do it, I thought, and I can do it this very moment. With all my heart, I vowed, my happiness, my body and my mind, my life, my everything, all of these from this very day I offer for the sake of humanity. This is developing bodhicitta, by the way, the desire to come to awakening for the benefit of all beings. The moment I said this, I was overcome with a sense of happiness like none I had ever experienced before. For the first time, I knew the bright clarity of the mind that is attached to nothing and the richness of the heart that has given everything. I composed a long appeal, I have no idea now what it said, and handed it to Ekai Roshi, entreating him to accept me as a disciple. The master's younger brother, Hanzui, was there by his side, sternly lecturing me on the severity of monastic training and warning me that a lukewarm sense of purpose wouldn't suffice to see it through. I remained determined, though. Seeing this, Ekai Roshi decided to check my father's position on the matter and, without a word to me, sent him a letter. I have no idea how surprised, how disappointed, or how angry my father might have been when he read it. All I remember is that he came and took me to Otsutsu in Nagoya, where we called upon a fortune teller named Watanabe Ichigyu. Watanabe didn't ask me anything, but just looked closely at the features of my face. He then said to my father, "This child will never be a family man. He has the features of someone who prefers solitude. Even if you make him take a wife, he's the sort of person who will go upstairs when she's downstairs and go downstairs when she comes upstairs. Best to have him become a fortune teller, a Shinto priest, or a Buddhist monk." My wish having finally been granted, I entered the Snow Mountain Monastery as a postulant at the end of my 19th year. The monastery had just moved from Yayoi-cho to Miyanagi-cho in Nezu, Tokyo. I wasn't allowed to wear a monk's robe yet, so I wore a black kimono with a black hakama, the lay clothing. During the day, I attended Toyo University with my head shaved slick as an egg. In the mornings, we would arise at 4 o'clock and start the day by wiping the floors and making preparations for breakfast. At 5, we would hit the wooden han while reciting the verses of impermanency with the plaintive cadences of the Obaku Zen stool. After school, we would sweep the garden and heat the bath. Once a week, Iwata Takuho, my senior at Snow Mountain, and I would go to the vegetable market in Dosaka to buy supplies. I was a combination housemaid and live-in working student. And since I was there at my own request, I was a housemaid and working student who also paid for his own room and board. The master was 80 years old at the time, but his mother was still alive, living at the monastery, though largely bedridden. It was my job to prepare her meals and take care of her bedpan, and I was genuinely happy to be allowed to do so. My lay name was Chojiro, so she used to affectionately call me Choyan, Choyan. Sometimes she would hold up her thumb and say, "Is he here?" referring to the master. If he was out, she would pull some money out from under her mattress and say, "Go buy some sea bream and cook it up for me." The master was a strict vegetarian, to the point where on trips he would take his own pots, since he found those of other people reek of cooked flesh. So I prepared his mother's fish in a special pot she kept. When I brought it to her, her face would break out in a huge smile of delight. It made me think that a pure living monk makes an unfilial son. Ekai Roshi, a rigid follower of the precepts, would not allow any solid food to be taken between noon and the following morning. Breakfast consisted of a large Tibetan-style pot of dark miso soup in which the cook would boil a handful of dried noodles until they were soft. Lunch, which apparently followed the dietary ideas promoted by Kawaguchi's friend Dr. Futaku Kenzo, was a stew containing 1 sho, which is 1.8 liters of brown rice, 1 go, which is 0.18 liters of asuki beans, and 1 go of rolled barley, together with various chopped vegetables. Ekai Roshi is the sort of person who would put down his chopsticks and stop eating the moment the noon bell sounded, even if he was still in the middle of his meal. If he happened to be out on business that kept him away till after 12 o'clock, he would go without lunch that day. At the beginning of the next school semester, Iwata Tokuhu finally had enough, saying, "If I stay in a place like this any longer, I'll ruin my health." He packed up his things and left, all the while entreating me to take good care of myself. With his departure, I was the only monk there. Even so, I labored devotedly from morning till night in the service of the Roshi and his mother. Looking back, I can't help being impressed by the single-minded devotion to the way that I was capable of at that time in my life. I still had a kind of childlike purity and innocence. The various bad habits I've acquired since then had yet to manifest themselves. Even so, fatigue, lack of sleep, and malnutrition gradually undermined my congenitally weak constitution. I finally suffered a physical breakdown during the final exams for my sophomore year at Toyo University. A week-long fever left my lymph nodes swollen to the point where my neck was wider than my face. And this was TB, tuberculosis. Early in the summer, I made my way to Taguchi, a town not far from my home village that served as the county seat, to take my physical examination for military conscription. The inspecting officer measured my height, weight, and the circumference of my chest, and then said to me, "We have no use for you. Get out." My weight, as I still clearly remember, was a merely 37 kilograms, so he was well under 100 pounds. I received a paper saying exempt from military service, stamped with characters and a red official seal. My physical condition being what it was, I had no choice but to quit Snow Mountain Monastery, which I had entered with such great expectations, and take my leave of Tokyo. Once again, I was home in the village I thought I had left for good, my emaciated body prostrate in bed with its swollen neck. And the next section is titled Facing Death. The doctors at Koseikan Hospital in Nagoya recommended surgical excision of my TB, for that was what my illness was, while the radiologists at Aichi Hospital assured me that they could disperse the lesions with x-rays. The internists at Matsunami Hospital then advised against both, telling me that after surgery the TB would soon recur and that radiation therapy would simply drive the pathology deeper into my body. "Your internal organs are so weak," they told me, "that you have to recover your strength before considering any treatment." In their opinion, it was best I return to Busetsu to recuperate, since the village had good clean air. Following their advice, I returned to my home and resumed my bedridden existence. By a strange coincidence, at just around this time, my older brother, the one who had used the envelope at the company he was employed at, was also taken ill and was accepted as an inpatient at Matsunami Hospital. In June of the following year, my mother, who had been staying at the hospital caring for him, came back holding an urn with his ashes. Sitting by my pillow, she said, "Don't cry, don't cry. You mustn't lose strength. Your older brother is dead." And then broke down in tears herself. Although my brother's illness had been mild compared to mine, the tuberculosis had spread to his throat and infected his larynx, finally taking his life. In the end, he was unable even to swallow water, and his death had been a painful one. One day, toward the end of the rainy season, the nunten bushes were covered with white buds. For the first time in quite a while, I left my bed and went out on the veranda to look at the garden. A cool, pleasant breeze blew softly against my cheek as though to soothe my exhausted body. I wondered how many years it had been since I'd felt a breeze like that. Then I thought to myself, what is the wind? And all of a sudden it struck me that wind is simply moving air. The moment I realized this, I felt a shock as though I'd been struck on the back with an iron rod. Yes, of course, I thought. There's air. In the entire 20 years since I'd been born, I'd been sustained and nurtured by air, but had never been truly aware of its existence. Yet even though I had paid no attention to the air had constantly and unfailingly embraced me. When I realized this, I broke out in tears and wept uncontrollably. The thought came to me, I'm not alone. I'm not isolated. Behind me is a great power that sustains me, continually urging me to live. I'll get better. I felt to the marrow of my bones that our life is not our own, but something given to us. My heart became clear and bright, and I recited a simple poem to myself. From the coolness of this morning's breeze, I know that I am embraced by something great. Ever since falling ill, I had taken a great liking to tanka poetry, writing verse and reading contemporary poets such as Wakayama Bokusui, Kitahara Hakushu, and Kuboto Utsubo in the popular collection Ichiaku no Suna were the only things that eased my loneliness and suffering. At about this time, an old fortune teller from Neba in Shinshu, who used to visit us regularly, advised that fortune would be with me if I stayed for 40 days or longer somewhere to the north of Busetsu. It was therefore decided that I would spend the summer with my younger brother in the city of Kaga, taking the waters at Yamanaka Hot Springs Resort. I rented rooms at the Yamatoya Bekkan, a hotel that overlooked the mountain stream flowing through the valley, and spent the summer soaking in the mineral baths, writing poetry, and visiting temples. The temples I visited were three that were associated with the Jodo Shin school. These temples had taken it upon themselves to offer sermons three times a day, morning, afternoon, and evening, with the temples taking turns of 1 week each to provide the service every day of the year. As they were located in a well-known hot springs resort, they found it easy to attract first-rate speakers whose talks I made sure I never missed during the months I was there. Listening to these speakers was an invaluable help to me in learning the art of public speaking. By this time, I'd recovered sufficiently to go to Nagoya and receive radiation therapy. I stayed at a temple called Ryoju-ji, not far from the great Shinto shrine Atsuta Jingu. For meals, I would go to a fish wholesaler named Toyotoshi, the owner of which had close ties to my father, where I would be treated to raw fish. After about 2 or 3 months, the proprietress of Toyotoshi asked me how the radiation therapy was going. When I answered that I hadn't seen the slightest improvement, she commented somewhat cryptically, "I know a good place. I'm sure you'd get better. But if I took you there, the priest would get angry." When I asked her what she meant, she explained that just north of Lake Hamana, to the east of Nagoya, there was a temple named Konchi-in, the priest of which could cure even the most intractable illnesses. She said that she herself had been cured of uterine cancer. I had heard about this temple before, but had dismissed such talks since I was convinced that Buddhism, which dabbled in healing, was deviant, and that any priest who engaged in such activities was a fraud. But I paid more attention when I heard that Konchi-in's priest scolded the proprietress when she introduced new patients. If the priest was a fraud, I thought, surely he would welcome new patients, not get angry. With this in mind, I decided to call upon Konchi-in and meet its priest, Reverend Kono Daike. This priest was to become my second master. I still remember the date when I met him, November 26th of my 22nd year. I can truly say that it is thanks to Reverend Kono that I'm alive today. My meeting him was a fortuitous encounter, oddly similar to that of Zen Master Hakuin with the Taoist hermit Hakuyu. I will not go into details of Reverend Kono's therapy here. Were I to do so, the temple would no doubt be inundated by an endless wave of the incurably ill, and I would be swamped with more requests for advice than I could possibly handle. For the time being, let me just say that I hope to focus more on this matter when I'm better able to deal with it physically. And the word that has come down to us over the years is that he cured himself with a tea made from the leaves of a particular tree that grows widely in Japan. And in fact, the man who he's since died. A great conglomerate in Japan. When his wife was dying of TB, Yamaramumon Roshi gave him the recipe for this tea, and she was cured as well. And that meant this man's undying gratitude both to Momonoshi, and because he was living in Okayama, where Sogenji was, also to Harutaroshi. And we used to go on Takuhatsu there, where he would have all of his employees line up after he entertained us with some curious food, very Western-style food. It's sort of like you take inexpensive hot dog buns and you put cream filling in them of different artificial flavors, strawberry and so on. And that was what we were fed. And I'm sure he was assuming that he was giving the Western students treats that they would enjoy because they were Western treats. When I first visited Konchi Inn, Reverend Kono held up three fingers and said, "Your illness is nothing more than this." When I gave him a blank look, he shouted, "Blockhead! I'm saying you'll be well in 3 months. Don't you see? Your internal organs are not weak. They're strong, so strong that they force the disease toxins up to your neck. Can't you get my point?" It was quite a Zen-style wake-up call, but it left me feeling more dazed than ever. Even so, Reverend Kono treated me very kindly, allowing me to stay at Konchi Inn and receive treatment. In March of the following year, when 3 months had passed, the priest said, "I haven't deceived you. Your life is no longer in danger, so feel free to go wherever you like. Do you plan to go back to Tokyo and resume that ascetic training?" "If I return to the monastery in Tokyo, I'll ruin my health again," I replied. "I'd like to go to Kyoto and practice Zazen." "You're not ready to train yet at a Zen monastery," Reverend Kono said. "You should enter the Zen college and focus on study for a while." So it was decided that in April I would enter Rinzai-shu College, affiliated with Myo Shinji, the great Rinzai Zen head temple in Kyoto. This was the school that is now called Hanazono University. My recovery was nothing short of miraculous. Though still not 100% cured, I was nevertheless in good enough health after a mere 3 months of treatment to fully resume my university studies. During the 40 years since then, I've continued to use this form of therapy to maintain my health and have never once had to see a doctor. After moving to Kyoto, I became increasingly active. Not long after entering the college, I recruited a few like-minded students and established a club for the advancement of Buddhism. On the 14th of every month, we would go in front of the main hall of Seiganji in Shinkyogoku in downtown Kyoto, set up flags and paper lanterns, and deliver street-side sermons to anywhere whoever wished to listen. On the 25th of each month, we would do the same at Kitano Tenmangu, the great Shinto shrine in northwest Kyoto. I would stand there on the stone steps and start my sermons by shouting out in a loud voice, "Those with eyes to see, look! Those with ears to hear, listen!" Looking back, it's hard to imagine how such a thing was possible for a young man who'd been at the door of death mere months before. Even as I engaged in such activities, however, I never felt the desire to abandon Christianity and the Bible. Each and every Sunday, I would attend services at a church somewhere. At the time, Rinzai-shu College only accepted the disciples of Rinzai School Temple, so for convenience sake, I had registered as the disciple of Konchi Inn and wore a monk's robe. It was in this robe that I always went to church. One event that helped me feel more confident was my participation in the English-speaking contest for university students hosted by Osaka Mainichi newspaper. This was the first such contest ever held in Japan. There were about 14 or 15 contestants, one of whom was a young woman who stood out for the bright red color she wore, while I, as usual, stood out for my plain black robes. The event was held in the red brick lecture hall of a Christian university, Kwansei Gakuin, located on the site of what is now Ojien Koen Park. The speech I delivered that day was entitled, "Not Relying on Words and Letters." After the presentations were finished, one of the judges, a certain Mr. F. Parrott, who worked for a Bible publisher, came over to my seat. He shook my hand and asked, "Where did you learn English?" Then made a number of comments like, "Your understanding of Christianity is excellent," and "Zen is interesting," hoping perhaps to strike up a conversation. But unfortunately, my English-speaking abilities weren't up to much more than delivering a speech at a podium. Mr. Parrott must have been disappointed. In any event, quite to my satisfaction, I made it through the final round of the contest at the Mainichi Hall in Osaka, where I received some sort of commemorative gift. Prior to the contest, I had asked Reverend Hatanaka to look my speech over. One thing he did was to go through the text and change all of the I's to we's. This left a profound impression on me, and at Rochester Zen Center, Kapla Roshi also did the same thing. He never spoke in the sense of I. He always spoke in the sense of we, and encouraged his students to do the same. So this left a profound impression on me. Indeed, I took it more to heart than anything I'd read in the Bible. It brought home to me the principle that we must never emphasize the I, but must always live with the we in mind. And then he did actually graduate from Hanazono University and eventually became the president of Hanazono University as well. But he talks about it a little bit here. Rinzai Shu College, as it was called then, also held a Zen retreat, Sashin, every semester. Everyone would repair to Empukji Monastery in Yawata, south of Kyoto, and practice Zazen for 1 week. These sessions remain among my most pleasant memories of my time at college. Even though I always had quite a profound devotion to Christianity, I always had great difficulty with the concept of prayer. Words of prayer are something I have never been able to utter. If I force myself to speak them, the words immediately turn false, transforming into the shallowest type of sentimentality. If I called out God the Father, God seemed to recede even farther away, ceasing to be the absolute beyond all concepts and becoming no more than an idol formed of ideas. Little wonder is it that Christ warned his followers against praying in front of the crowds as the hypocrites do. Rather, he enjoined them to, quote, enter your private room and pray in secret alone with God. Moreover, it always seemed to me that in praying one needs no words, for does not God already know all things? After I began practicing Zazen, I came to regard this practice as the truest form of prayer. In Zazen, one settles oneself openly in front of the Absolute, totally forgets the ego, and enters a state of no mind where not a single thought stirs. One utterly surrenders oneself, body and mind, in the Absolute, so that self and Absolute are fully one. Could there possibly be any higher expression of prayer than this? In this clear, bright mind, pure as that of an infant, there is not a speck of sentimentality, but only a full immersion in the joyful union of the human and the divine. This, I believe, is the meaning of the famous Beatitude, blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God. In the purity of heart, God is present. One semester, when time for Sashin arrived, my schoolmates and I took our sitting cushions and daily necessities and sequestered ourselves in the great Zen monastery of Enpukuji to the south of Kyoto. Enpukuji has a huge meditation hall, but with 50 or 60 people sitting, it was filled to capacity. That particular Sashin, the classmate sitting directly across the aisle from me, was a profoundly accomplished mediator. Yeah, I think he means meditator here. Prior to entering Rinzai Shu College, he had spent several years practicing Zazen at Shofukuji Monastery in Hakata, Kyushu. Whenever my leg pain became unbearable, I'd glance over and see him sitting like a firmly rooted tree. Whenever I became sleepy, I'd glance over at him and see him sitting without the slightest movement. Whenever my body grew listless, I'd glance over at him and see him sitting as solidly as ever. I aroused a great fighting spirit and sat with determination to do every bit as well as him. By the fourth or fifth day, I reached the point where I forgot body and mind, with no sense of sitting as I sat and no sense of standing as I stood. It was truly a stillness in which human and divine were one. On the sixth day, I was returning from Sanzen with a Roshi when I happened to see the bright yellow leaves of the ginkgo tree in front of the main hall. At that moment, my mind suddenly opened, and I was so astonished that I almost leapt into the air. The koan mu exploded, and the world of absolute reality manifested before me. I rushed back to the Sanzen room and immediately passed my koan as well as several other problems presented to me by the master. The gate of the celestial rock cave suddenly opened and the divine act of creation unfolded in all its infinity. Everything is new. Everything is beautiful. Everything is true. Everything is shining. Everything is self. I was in a state of utter ecstasy. This, I thought, is what is meant when they speak of, without realizing it, my hands were waving and my feet were dancing with joy. Cosmos and I are one. The world and I are one. Humanity and I are one. With the full intuition of this, how could one not be overcome with joy? I fully savored as the reality of my own experience Shakyamuni's words that, quote, the totality of the three realms is my very being, and every creature therein is my child, close quote, and saw that in them there was no exaggeration and no deceit. I realized that this non-dual love toward humanity and the world is the ultimate truth of human nature. The bodhicitta expressed all those years ago when I vowed to offer my happiness, my body and my mind, my life, my everything for the sake of humanity was itself the essence of human nature. I knew then in my heart that my aspiration to seek the way had not been mistaken. The Zen master leading the session at Empukuji was Kozuki Teshu Roshi, who at the time was the president of Rinzai Shu College and later became chief abbot of Myoshinji. The classmate whose sitting had so impressed and motivated me was Shirozu Keizan, who went on to become master of Heirinji Monastery near Tokyo. His presence made me realize how important good companions are if one hopes to attain the way. Even today, I feel a great sense of gratitude towards him. Many people think that students are not in a situation that allows them to awaken to their true nature, or that people in lay life are unable to experience enlightenment. But this way of thinking is simply not true. There's a Japanese expression, a mouse attacks a cat. That refers to the fact that anything is possible if one is desperate enough. With sufficient motivation, anyone can attain enlightenment. One day on Shinkyokoku Street, I ran into a priest I knew named Murakami Dokutan, who had been a fellow student at Toyo University. He'd subsequently become priest of Jisaiin, an important sub-temple of the large Zen temple complex Tenryuji, located in Arashiyama, on the western outskirts of Kyoto. He invited me to come for a visit, so one day I made my way to Arashiyama and called on him. We talked at length, and one subject led to another until we came up with the idea to start a Sunday school at his temple. That was the start of a deep connection with Tenryuji, where I ended up living for the next 20 years, which I regard as my second home. After some time, I was introduced to Sekisei Setsu Roshi, who had just assumed duties as the new chief abbot of Tenryuji. The moment I met him, I knew that I had finally met the true teacher whom I had been seeking for so many years, a teacher with whom I could entrust my life. Seisetsu Roshi told me, I will give you everything I possess, but I wonder how much of the master's immense spiritual wealth I was truly able to receive. When I graduated from Rinzai Shu College, I entered Tenryuji Monastery as an unsui, that's a novice monk, and served the master until his death on October 2, 1945, following about like a shadow and received his benevolent instruction. As I look back on the 50 years that have passed since I left my village in the mountains at the age of 14, I remember with a deep sense of gratitude, Seisetsu Roshi, and all of the wonderful guides and teachers whom I have encountered. Yet, as Confucius said, you can't carve rotten wood, and I can only reflect with shame on how much I still have left to accomplish. And that is Ramon Roshi's autobiography. And we've already been here for almost an hour, so I think I will share this little bit of teaching that I've managed to find of his beyond his autobiography, which is quite teaching enough. And we will stop now and recite the four vows. And I thank you very much for listening.